You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 13th to the 19th of November 2014. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by news editor Simon Baker, deputy features editor Paul Jump, and writer Matthew Rice. If universities look towards the EU to increase student numbers, and our lead news story this week suggests that they will, how will the student loans system cope? That's our lead story this week. Simon will have more on that in a second. Academics' gripes with pre-publication peer review are well documented, but what about post-publication review? Paul Jump's been taking a closer look at that this week. And a musical lecture exploring the links between three individuals connected by the Nuremberg trials has its premiere in London this month. Matthew will tell us a little bit more about it later. But first, to that splash written by John Morgan, who's not here. So, Simon, it's over to you. The cap on undergraduate student numbers in the UK is lifted next year, of course. And this story is all about the fact that universities might look to Europe to get more numbers in, but with some potentially problematic repercussions.
Well, Europe. It's just everywhere at the moment, isn't it?
It is.
It's all over Europe, anyway.
It's certainly all over, yeah. I think the issue here basically is that, you know, with the cap being lifted, this is a potential for universities to really pull in some extra students. That's all income these days when it comes to the fact that the £9,000 attached to each one. And with a kind of cohort of 18-year-olds, when it comes to demographics, it's not really going up, put it that way, at the moment. There's a question mark about, yeah, so how can we get some extra income in? Well, an obvious workplace to expand is the EU. Mm. This has been kind of a suggestion before, but now there is sort of direct evidence that universities are looking to get more EU students in when the cap's lifted. The Managing Director for Higher Education, UK and Europe at Study Group, it's a private provider that basically offers pathway courses to prepare international students for a degree, is saying that universities have been coming to him saying, how can you work with us to get more EU students in, with the idea that they would go on the pathway courses first. I mean, the pathway courses have traditionally been non-EU students, but there will be EU students that obviously can be prepared for degrees through these courses and enable the universities to pull them in. The reason why this is a problem is that obviously the potential unsustainability of the student loan system is well documented, but EU students carry a particular problem in that repayment rates aren't really as high. There's percentages, if you look at the official figures from the SLC from last year, showing that 11% of EU students liable to repay who are resident overseas had not provided details of their income, had been placed in arrears. Yeah, 19% defined as not currently repaying. I mean, obviously this could potentially play into the hands of certain tabloid newspapers and UKIP, this kind of story, but, you know, we're just these are facts about repayment. And if you have potential for more loans need to be written off if they're EU students, then it doesn't take a genius to work out that there's pressure on the
system.
In terms of the taxpayer funding of it, yeah.
Are we to assume from universities' interest in recruiting more students that in fact the £9,000 fee does perfectly well cover the cost of tuition? If they were making a loss on each student, nobody would be wanting.
They wouldn't want to get more students.
Yeah.
That's good. It's a fair suggestion. I suppose universities would still argue that, that's all very well. Yes, it does in certain subjects.
Yeah,
so
of course.
As long as we recruit them in the right subjects, then yeah, we will be covering our tuition costs. But we will ensure that there's a mix, really, so that we cross subsidise and that we overall we are making money. They will still argue that there are subjects that they're losing money.
I suppose the money issue, it comes down to central government funding as well, doesn't it? Because the One of the figures brought out by John Morgan in that piece is that the amount of outstanding debt among EU students with income contingent loans went up fivefold between 2009-2010 and 2012-2013. I mean, in a sense, I suppose it's just easier to hide, I guess, the further away from the UK you are once you graduate. If you disappear back to Europe, who's keeping tabs?
Well, I suppose it's not so much easier to hide. I suppose it's just that if you're then working in the UK, the tax system recoups the money. It does it through PAYE, and you pay your salary and you're docked your student loan money. There's nothing you can do about it. You know, you're in the system. If you go abroad, you're not part of the Inland Revenue system anymore, are you? So you actually have to chase those people.
Of course, it's the same issue.
There's a lot more burden on the SLC to find that money, isn't there?
I mean, it's the same issue as UK students who then go and work abroad, isn't it? That
yeah.
There's very low repayment rates for them as well.
Exactly. It's not particularly a... I think it's be very easy, and of course, like I say, certain tabloid newspapers might want to take that line to say that, well, this suggests that EU students are more likely to not pay their loans. But as Paul says, I think it's to do with the fact that if you're in the UK and part of the tax system, then it's automatic, that repayment. And if you're outside, you're not.
Well, the full story's on page 6 and 7 this week. Elsewhere in our news section, the latest on the pension row. We have the return as well of Wendy Purcell as Vice-Chancellor of Plymouth, something which our reporter John Morgan tweeted was the greatest comeback since Elvis, Lazarus or Cheryl on X Factor. Make of that what you will. Moving on, Paul, to your research intelligence piece this week, which looks at post-publication peer review and asks if it's legally viable.
Yeah, I mean, it's not really a sort of comprehensive look at post-publication peer review so much as a look at what, if anything, is implied by a legal challenge in the US to a site called PubPeer that allows post-publication peer review. You can pick any paper, basically, and comment on it. Needless to say, lots of the comments that it attracts are negative.
Yeah.
Because, you know, why else really would you make the effort? And one guy is a guy called Fazlul Sarkar, who's a cancer researcher at Wayne State University in Detroit. He's taken particular umbrage at some comments on the site about his papers that essentially... though we shouldn't repeat the libel here, essentially sort of imply that there's been some kind of misconduct going on. He, at the point that all this appeared in this summer, he actually had a job offer from the University of Mississippi, a very lucrative one as well, $350,000 a year. He had been formally offered that and formally accepted it, but it was then promptly withdrawn when somebody at Mississippi saw all this stuff on PubPeer. Needless to say, Professor Sarkar wasn't very impressed with that, called his lawyer, and launched legal action. And although he can't actually sue PubPeer, he has subpoenaed it to try and get the names of the people who did libel him, in his view. So that case isn't resolved yet.
Because it's anonymous, those comments are anonymous on this site, which doesn't help, does it, with internet sort of reviews of this form?
Well, I suppose that's the issue, really, that the article looks at. I mean, clearly, if you want to elicit comments that really, really look hard at a paper and really question whether it's valid or not, clearly anonymity helps there. Particularly if you're a young researcher, you're not likely to stick your neck out and say, you know, you don't really trust somebody's results if your own position is not secure. So if you want, if you want really robust post-publication peer review, you arguably need anonymity. On the other hand, anonymity also permits people potentially to go over the line and to say libelous things.
And in theory, it could be that interested parties, rivals for the same job or something.
I suppose, yeah.
Deliberate attempts to discredit you for some interested reasons.
Yeah, I mean, that could happen, or people just get the wrong end of the stick. I mean, obviously, as journalists, we're always very wary of libel, and unless we can really prove things, particularly around issues like misconduct, we tend not to report them. you know, there's the potential on post-publication sites where people are anonymous, you know, to be a lot more gung-ho about that kind of thing, for better or for worse, you know, and clearly that has potential for things to get very litigious very quickly and potentially undermine the whole, you know, potential for post-publication peer review to really take off.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a fascinating issue. I mean, the big question for me is, and this crops up with anything to do with the internet really and libel, and includes things that are said on Twitter really as well, and all the cases that cropped up in the last few years on that, is that the question I would ask is, why should the internet have different rules from things that are printed on paper really? I mean, you would never, would you ever have been able to anonymously say things about a particular piece of writing or scientific research or anything in the past without that kind of attracting some kind of libel action? Why should we have different rules for the internet?
Well, it depends what you do with it. I mean, traditional peer review does involve essentially anonymity. I mean, the reviewers, although they're known to the editor, they're not known to the person. But yes, the point is that those are not published, therefore people don't feel the need to sue. I guess the point about the internet is it's there for everybody to see, and so therefore the incentive to sue is a lot greater.
So it's no different from, say, saying that all those peer review comments that are already made pre-publication were just published at the end of a journal.
Hmm.
And it's no, I mean, that doesn't happen now for that very reason, because everyone can see it. So why should the rule be any different for the internet?
Well, indeed, yeah. I mean, it's worth saying that actually some journals do publish their peer reviews, but obviously the peer reviewers know that and no doubt tailor their phraseology accordingly.
It's an interesting discussion that will run and run, no doubt, but page 20 and 21 for Paul's piece this week. Matthew, we can usually count on you to bring us news of the weird and the wonderful in academia. This week it's a musical lecture coming to London at the end of the month. Would you care to elaborate?
Yeah, well, it's quite a slightly complex story. Philippe Sands, who's a very well-known professor of law at University College London, and is also a barrister and works in the field of humanitarian law, recently acted on behalf of the government of Croatia against Serbia, claiming that the events in Vukovar were a genocide. And he was invited to the city of Lviv in the Ukraine to talk on this sort of issue. And Lviv is one of these places, sort of the heartlands of some of the most violent and dramatic events in 20th century history, which has changed its name and country several times, yes. And he went along. It seemed interesting, and partly because his maternal grandfather had come from there, and he then discovered that the two great theoreticians of his branch of international law, humanitarian law, who'd kind of invented the concept of genocide and the concept of crimes against humanity, had both studied at Lemberg, as it then was. And then he also discovered that this was the very town where a man called Hans Frank was appointed by the Nazis to govern occupied Poland. He turned up. The first thing he did was organise a concert, and the second thing he did was unleash the final solution. Hmm. So this was kind of, so he was thinking about this place. He was very fascinated by the city itself. And then he discovered that all these people were also sort of passionate music lovers. And so the people who kind of ended up on opposite sides of the Nuremberg trials, the people prosecuting and the Nazi on trial, they all independently said that it was very stressful and difficult for them, but they'd sought consolation in the music of Bach. And he just thought it was really fascinating that sort of both the Nazi and the prosecutor, the Nazis, were sort of listening to the same music and saying how wonderful it was. And this led him to create this sort of musical lecture, which he's delivering with Vanessa Redgrave, is the other actor who's performing with him, and a pianist and bass baritone, bringing together all this music and reflecting on the ethics of art and the sort of personal background to the law and the kind of way that these kind of complex 20th century history sort of is linked in this particular city. Mm. I think I've read the text. I think it should be really interesting.
Yeah, yeah, and it's the lecture is one part of a quartet of work, isn't it? That Felipe is putting
yes,
together.
He's doing all sorts of things while also being an academic and prosecuting government. So he's a busy man, but certainly involved in a very interesting project.
Yeah, well, that piece is being performed at the South Bank Centre in London on the 29th and 30th of November. You can read about it on page 44 of this week's Times Higher Education. That's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast. If you want to comment on anything we've discussed, please do get in touch via timeshighereducation.co.uk. You'll also find us on Twitter and Facebook, on LinkedIn and on Google+. But that's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.